Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled, Reduce Your Safety Certification by at least $2 million. My name is John McHale, Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speaker today is Dr. Edwin DeYoung, Vice President of Sales for RTI. Edwin has more than 20 years' experience in the software industry. He is one of the pioneers in the development of large-scale, real-time, publish-describe middleware that is now helping to enable the Internet of Things. He previously served as Director of Product Management and Strategy at RTI. Edwin joined the company in 2005 following RTI's acquisition of ForTec, a company he co-founded in 2002 and led as CEO. Prior to leading ForTec, Edwin worked as a research and development manager at Talus. He was a software consultant for the application of real-time publish-subscribe middleware in the development of combat management systems and has co-authored more than 25 published technical articles. Edwin holds a PhD in mathematics and physics from Leiden University, the Netherlands. Now for some short housekeeping announcements. The eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. But before we get going, I want to point out three very important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you will be able to view the slides in full screen mode. The second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to send an email request for this event. The third button on your console window allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Now, I'm pleased to turn it over to Edwin. Edwin, take it away.
Thank you for the introduction, John. Hello, everybody. Welcome to our webinar today, and thank you for joining us. In this webinar, you'll learn how to save $2 million in software certification costs. And if you think that sounds like an awfully exact number, in reality, the cost reduction is, of course, a range around this number, and the actual reduction will depend on your project's requirements. But we will see later in this webinar how that works exactly. Though largely this webinar is inspired by recent developments in unmanned aircraft or UAVs, a lot of what we talk about today also applies to other applications with safety certification requirements. But a lot of the examples that we will be using are related to UAVs. The design of modern UAVs requires a challenging and unique integration of various safety-critical components. So those include processors, operating systems, communication technology, and, of course, application software. And what makes the design of these systems even harder today is the increasing requirement to meet DO-178 safety certification or similar criteria. So unmanned aircraft systems today or in the near future are no longer a simple combination of one UAV and one ground control station fulfilling a single mission requirement. Instead, it's a network of multiple UAVs from different vendors carrying configurable payloads and multiple ground control stations also from a variety of system integrators. And these are all working together to meet multiple and continue changing mission requirements. And the challenge will be to ensure that data and capabilities from the smart sensors and other payloads on board the UAV are accessible to every relevant participant in the environment. So just a simple example, target data obtained by a sensor on board a UAV, extrapolated from a video stream, may need to be shared with any number of combat systems out in the field over any number of different communication links and all in real time. And in all that, the efficient use of the available communication infrastructure plays a key role. And we see that processing technology is advancing faster than the communications infrastructure itself. And this means that sensors on board payloads will become smarter and more autonomous. And UAVs will process data more extensively, so only the most important information gets passed to the commander in the field. On one hand, this serves to decrease the bandwidth load, which is of course good. On the other hand, we must make sure that the processed mission-critical data is distributed reliably. And this is true not only for the air-to-ground data link, but also for the networks and buses on board the airframe itself, since bigger airframes often have an onboard LAN, local network. And it's also true for the high-speed interconnects like Ethernet networks in the ground control stations. And with the increased requirements from the DoD forces for interoperability between UAVs, payloads, and ground control stations, we see that point-to-point integration between these systems is actually already obsolete. And what is needed instead is a systems of systems architecture and supporting communication infrastructure. And that infrastructure then allows any endpoint to connect to any other endpoint in the system, whether it's on the same network or not. So the challenge then becomes how to design an unmanned aircraft system around a communication platform that spans the entire UAS, so from the onboard network on the LAN down to the ground control station and between the subsystems in the ground control station. So what are the basic capabilities that are needed for such a global communications infrastructure for UAS? Well, first of all, the infrastructure needs to be standard-based. That's basically a no-brainer. That's the only way to achieve the desired interoperability between systems. It must also be peer-to-peer. There can be no single point of failure or performance bottleneck, obviously. And it must work across all the link and networking technologies, so across radio links between UAVs and ground control stations, and across the high-speed interconnects, such as 10 gig Ethernet in the ground control stations, and the tactical link to the backbone systems. And similarly, it must work across heterogeneous computer platforms, so like ruggedized desktop systems in the ground control station, embedded platforms running real-time operating systems on board the UAV, or time and space partitions platforms like ARINC 653. And that is really the focus of today's webinar, is that the platform, the infrastructure, must be a certifiable component. With the integration of UAVs in national airspace, we see that safety certification is becoming more and more a requirement for these types of systems. And we'll talk a lot more about that in this webinar. So what's listed here are essentially the gating conditions for a communication infrastructure. Without meeting these requirements, the communication infrastructure cannot be implemented in a UAV. So with the exception of safety certification, a communication platform that meets these baseline capabilities already exists today, and that's the Data Distribution Service, or DDS standard, from the OMG, the Object Management Group. And I don't know if you're familiar with the OMG, the Object Management Group, but it's a standards organization, and it's the same organization that manages standards like UML and CORBA. And DDS is also one of their standards. If you're not familiar with DDS, I will provide a quick introduction here to the basic concepts. And if you are familiar with it, then consider it as a quick refresher. I won't linger too long on DDS because we want to quickly get to safety certification, which is the main topic of this webinar. So quick historical perspective, work on the standard, the DDS standard, started back in 2001 by RTI and various system integrators were involved as well, like Thales in Europe. And the first version was formally adopted by the OMG in 2004. And the first commercial DDS implementations started to appear in 2005, and we at RTI we're actually the first to offer a commercial implementation, and we've basically been the leading DDS vendor since. So back to DDS. At its very core, DDS provides a real-time data bus or messaging bus, and it provides a connectionless architecture. And by offering a connectionless architecture, it overcomes the problems like the brittleness and the lack of scalability and interoperability of point-to-point integration. So how does this connectionless architecture work? Applications are characterized as publishers or providers of data and subscribers or consumers of data. And there's no hard-coded interaction between the applications. All communication occurs through a common real-time data bus. So for example, on this slide, you see a sensor on the left side that publishes sensor data in real time. So this might be a radar or an infrared camera or any other type of sensor on board a UAV. And then there's a control application that subscribes to that sensor data. After it's subscribed to it, it will automatically start receiving updates from the sensor. And based on the received sensor data, the control application then produces commands for an actuator. And of course, actuators can be many things. They can be the flaps on the UAV. They can be a missile launcher or anything else. And there's no hard-coded knowledge in the applications about each other. So the sensor knows nothing about the control application and the other way around. And the data bus automatically discovers and connects the applications at runtime. And later we'll discuss how this discovery protocol works in safety certifiable systems. So in this example, no changes are required to existing applications when you add an additional sensor. So when you add an additional sensor in the configurable payload, you can do that, and it will automatically start publishing its data to the data bus. So the same is true when you add a display console, an additional display console in the ground control station, for example. The display console will automatically start receiving sensor data from the sensor and status information from the actuator once it's subscribed to that information, and no changes to the sensor and actuator are required to perform this type of integration. So another way to look at this is that connectivity between components becomes a runtime service rather than something that is hard-coded at design time. So DDS implements a real-time data bus, but there's more to it. Like a relational database, DDS lets you define the data schema. So in this example, we have a common track database that's shared, for example, between a group of UAVs, ground control stations, and other participants in the network. And this common data schema enables integration of subsystems and systems. It makes all system components agree on a common vocabulary. And during deployment, the data schema then gets populated with actual data. So for example, sensors will insert and update their reported tracks. The data bus maintains a distributed system state, and any component that is aware of the data schema can connect to it at any time and receive the latest system state. So the data bus provides fast and local access to the latest state by pushing updates onto the bus in real time. So in that way, you get fast local access that enables real-time system capabilities. So that's my quick introduction or refresher of DDS. DDS today is used in literally hundreds of applications. They all rely on DDS. And this slide gives you a quick flavor. And if you consider these DDS applications, you see that they're all systems that control or interact with physical processes. They basically form the infrastructure for the world around us. And these systems have a couple of important characteristics in common. For example, these systems tend to generate, and also often consume, huge amounts of data, like sensory data. And the accurate transmission and retrieval of that data is critical. Without this, these systems don't function correctly, and the implications of failure are usually severe. Failure can lead to loss of property, a UAV, for example, or even loss of life. And for this reason, reliability and safety are of critical importance to these systems. So now let's look into the safety requirement in more detail, and especially in avionics systems. So So the primary guideline for flight safety of avionics software is DL-178. And it's a guideline, it's used by the FAA as a basis for safety certification. It's important to understand that only whole systems are certified. So what gets certified in the end is the aircraft. And components, like software on board the aircraft, can be certifiable. This means that the software comes with certification evidence. So that's a set of documents and test results. And these can be used during the actual certification process. The latest revision of the guideline is DL-178C. It replaces the previous version B. And DL-178C brings the standard up to date with the latest software development practices, the latest tools, the latest technologies, and it also uses more precise language and terminology in many places. DL-178C also has more objectives for levels A, B, and C. So for example, at level A, DL-178B had 66 objectives. They're now 71 in DL-178C. Traditionally, DL-178 is applied in commercial avionics, as is required by the FAA. But as I said earlier, we now see it increasingly being used in military aircraft as well. And particularly, we see this for UAVs so that they can fly in national airspace. And initially, this is done mainly for repositioning of UAVs so that you don't have to take them apart and load them on a truck, because these things can actually fly. So to reposition them, you want to be able to fly them through national airspace. This affects UAVs as well as the ground control stations, though not necessarily at the same level of certification. So speaking of certification levels, in DL-178 there are 5 so-called design assurance levels. I won't go into the details of these levels. What I do want to point out is that in this webinar, we will be talking about the higher levels, so C, B, and all the way up to A, which is the highest level. Safety certification is not cheap. It costs between $50 to $100 per executable line of code. And that's just the cost for certification, not the cost for developing the code in the first place. And it's expensive because evaluation takes a lot of effort. You need to meet all objectives, so there are 71 at level A and 69 at level B. All the steps in the process must be documented in detail. The code must be developed with extra attention. It must be testable. There can be no dead code. The code must be deterministic. We'll talk more about these things in a minute. And also, you need to develop all the tests to give full code coverage, to get to full code coverage during testing. And of course, you need to run all those tests. And based on the results, you then need to go back and make modifications to the code, such that all tests pass. So there's a lot of effort that goes into that. And speaking of testing, there are primarily 3 levels of testing. The most basic one, that's the one at level C, is called SC, stands for statement coverage. And it means that every statement in a program is invoked at least once during testing. And the most common used term for this is code coverage. So this gives full code coverage. Next level up, we get DC, which stands for decision coverage. It means that every point of entry and exit in your program is invoked at least once, and it means that each decision, so think about an if statement or a loop, each decision is taken with all possible valuations. So basically it means that every Boolean expression is tested for both true and false. And then at level A, we get MCDC, which stands for Modified Condition Decision Coverage. It's the same as before, but then it adds that each condition in a decision is tested to independently affect the decision's outcome. So for example, when you have a condition A or B, if A always evaluates to true, then B never contributes to the decision. And basically then that becomes that component of the condition becomes essentially dead code, which of course cannot have been the intent. So this means with MCDC that complex Boolean expressions need to have truth tables to verify the value of each variable. Of course, all this testing can be done manually, but that takes a lot of effort. And fortunately, code coverage tools are available today to automate most of this work. But of course, you have to develop the tests. All right. So since software certification is not cheap, you must pay special attention to that when you're developing the software. Since the cost of certification is linearly proportional to the number of lines of code, you want to minimize the lines of code you write. So when designing, and also when designing certifiable software, keep in mind that every line must be tested. So that means that every component, every function, for example, needs to be well documented or self-explaining. Also, it means that you must make the state of each component controllable to a level needed by testing, and you must make intermediate and final results observable, for example, by logging messages. And each component must be designed such that they can be tested in isolation. And particularly, you must design the code to be deterministic. This means that the code always yields the same behavior, always has the same test result. It doesn't depend on time of day that you execute the code. There must always be the same test result. Given the input, the code always produces the same output. There are no side effects. And one possible source of non-determinism can be dynamic memory allocation. First of all, you can run out of memory at some point, which is obviously an issue. But dynamic memory allocation can also lead to memory fragmentation. And then compaction of the memory by the operating system is required, which is a source of time non-determinism. And if you dynamically allocate memory, you likely also need to free up that memory later on, and then garbage collection can again also be a source of non-determinism. So you must be very careful and have these things in mind when you design your safety certifiable software. So with that in mind, let's take a look at communication middleware. So commercial middleware implementations like DDS offer many features, and their code base can be easily hundreds of thousands of lines of code. Now just that line count of hundreds of thousands of line of code, multiply that by $50 to $100 per line of code to certify, and that basically makes certification of those types of software components economically not viable. So what we want instead is a middleware implementation that is specifically designed for safety certifiable systems. And of course, that implementation would have far fewer capabilities because as a result of that, it will have a reduced line count. Also, the middleware should only allow predictable behavior, so there can be no sources of non-determinism, which means, among other things, no dynamic memory allocation. And particularly for middleware, this can be challenging since the application's dimensions are unknown at the design time of the middleware. So this means that the middleware basically requires that applications are pre-configured for memory usage during their initialization phase. It doesn't mean that the middleware itself is pre-configured, just the applications are. And applications then will not change their resource consumption on the fly during runtime. We'll get back to this in more detail later. You also want to set limits to the size of the system, since this directly affects the size and complexity of data structures and algorithms that you use. So our general purpose DDS implementation, for example, can scale to many, many hosts and devices on a network, tens of thousands of nodes on the network, millions of data elements. And of course, this is not the size that you need on board an aircraft. Instead, we want a middleware implementation that fits the size of modern avionics systems, but no more. And then integration with larger and usually off-board systems can then be done through a bridge that on the other side run a full DDS implementation, for example. Okay, so how can we reduce the size and complexity of middleware? One key component is the use of data structures. Avionics systems have a limited scale and network size compared to large-scale enterprise-type systems. And as a result, the data structures in middleware that represent the connectivity state of the system can be different. For example, a data structure and a search algorithm for systems of hundreds of thousands of nodes is very different from an algorithm that needs to manage only hundreds of nodes. For hundreds of nodes, you can use a simple tree search algorithm or maybe even a linear search if your data set is really small. You also want to carefully balance the middleware capabilities versus the source code size. Obviously, the more capabilities you have, the larger the source code size and the more expensive it is to certify. And particularly DDS is feature rich, which is a good thing in general, but when it comes down to certification, you want to carefully weigh this against the cost of certification. So you want to select the feature set carefully that is required by most avionics and other safety critical systems. So as an example, in DDS we have partitions, and partitions allow you to create new logical networks at runtime, on the fly. This is very dynamic, and so it's harder to certify systems using it. And avionics systems typically have no need for this type of capability. And we'll get to the DDS feature set in a minute. So at RTI, we now have a special implementation of DDS available for systems that require safety certification. The code base is derived from our Connects DDS Micro product, which is a scaled-down DDS implementation for resource-constrained environments like onboard UAVs. It has a small memory footprint, and it has a reduced source code line count. And with that, it makes it commercially viable to develop certification evidence for Connects DDS Micro. The certifiable DDS implementation follows the OMG DDS specification. So for example, it implements the RTPS, the real-time publish subscribe wire protocol of DDS for compatibility. And that allows seamless integration with other general purpose DDS implementations. The certifiable DDS implements a subset of the standard DDS API, and what that subset is, we'll get back to that on the next slide. We also have a FACE-compliant interface currently under development, if you're familiar with FACE. We actually have a prototype implementation available, and if you're interested in trying out the FACE interface, contact us. We can make that available to you. But back to DDS. I just mentioned that certifiable DDS, of course, implements a subset of the full DDS API. And this slide shows at a high level what that subset is. And it requires some basic knowledge of DDS, at least of the DDS object model. So bear with me as we step through this at a very high level. So certifiable DDS supports multiple domains, so the network can be partitioned, and that is important, particularly for mixed criticality applications. With certifiable DDS, applications, of course, can create all the basic DDS objects or entities. It starts with a domain participant, which is essentially the entry point to a DDS network. So the applications will be able to create those and delete those. Domain participant is a factory for creating topics, and which the application then can publish and subscribe to. Both keyed and keyless topics are supported, And, of course, applications can also delete all the created entities at teardown of an application. Once an application is subscribed to a topic, it can, for example, pull data, so periodic processes would typically do this. Not all processes are periodic, though. Many processes, also in avionics and UAVs, respond to aperiodic or sporadic events. So the implementation also supports notification when new data arrives, so that you don't have to poll for it periodically. When new data is available, applications can either read or take that data. That means that an application can read the data and leave it in the cache for later reference, or it can take the data and remove it from the cache if it is no longer needed. If an application is publishing to a topic, it can, of course, write data to that topic, and it can use the time of writing as the timestamp. That's an internal timestamp. Or it can pass an application set timestamp. And, of course, applications can dispose stale data. So if you have a track that's been lost, you can dispose its instance. Publishers also maintain their liveliness, and this is based on a heart-beating mechanism to announce periodic availability of applications. And heartbeats are piggybacked on regular data traffic to save network bandwidth. And of course, the whole code base is designed to be threat safe. All right, so that's a quick overview of the features that are supported by our certifiable DDS implementation. Now, as the middleware creates new DDS objects like domain participants, publications, subscriptions, it is critically important how the middleware manages the memory for doing that. And memory management also plays a role when your application is sending or receiving data. And as we discussed earlier, dynamic memory allocation is a source of non-determinism. And there are two types of memory internal to the DDS middleware to be aware of here. There's the data cache, which keeps most recent values received for all data. And there is the discovery database, or the discovery cache, which keeps all metadata about all other hosts and devices in the network, all other nodes in the network. And it maintains a cache of remote publications and subscriptions. So this data cache grows as more data is produced. As there are more objects like land vehicles or aircraft to track in the environment, of course, the data cache will grow. Also, the send queue of the middleware can grow. For example, when a communication link goes temporarily bad, unacknowledged messages will stay in the queue until they are acknowledged. Similarly, the discovery database grows when more hosts and devices join. Now, for safety certifiable systems, it's critical that memory usage is deterministic. So the middleware requires that all resource limits are configured before creating the DDS entities. In this way, the memory is only allocated during the create calls of your DDS applications, which are performed during system setup and initialization. And after the system has been set up, after your application has gone through its initialization phase, there is no memory growth after that. And this is enforced by the middleware. Okay. Memory usage configuration of each entity is done through quality of service parameters. And the DDS standard offers more types of quality of service than just the ones for memory usage configuration. This slide shows you a quick overview of the major QoS available in the certifiable DDS implementation. And this, again, is a subset of all QoS offered by the full DDS standard. So first, let's take a look at the communication protocols. So our certifiable implementation of DDS supports both best effort and reliable communication. And you may think, of course, you know, for safety certification, we will absolutely need reliable communication. Well, actually, it depends on your application and your design. And sometimes you will find that safety and reliability can actually be at odds. As an example, in the research that we did when we were developing our certifiable DDS implementation, we came across a particular system design that does not use reliable communication at all. Data was simply sent over UDP, and all processes in the system were set up as periodic processes. So each process, when scheduled for execution, first reads its current input data, performs the required processing on the data, and sends the computed output values. The applications then use a real-time scheduler, and all processes are executed at a high frequency, so for example at 30 hertz or something like that. So with this type of design, the reliability protocol actually doesn't make much sense, because by the time that a missing packet is detected and a repair packet can be sent on the network, the next value is already available to be sent instead. So in this case, the reliability protocol can be a source of non-determinism, because any repair traffic can interfere with the regular high-frequency data traffic. Another QoS that is supported is durability, and for those who are more familiar with DDS, the durability settings that are supported are volatile and transient local. And using durability, an application can implement a last value cache, for example. So if a subscriber joins late, so after a publisher has already sent data to a topic, then if a subscriber joins later and subscribes to that topic, the published value is sent again from the publisher's data cache. In avionics systems, of course, we don't expect very dynamic behavior, so we don't expect publishers and subscribers to join and leave the system seemingly at random. But especially during system initialization, components will be brought online one by one. And the durability QoS during that phase helps, and it can help to avoid complex startup sequences. Also, it allows whole devices to be brought online or taken offline during operational use. Another type of QoS supported are the cache resource limits, so that includes maximum number of instances, history depth, and things like that. And these QoS are the QoS that control the memory usage configuration that we talked about earlier. And as I said, this can only be configured before publications and subscriptions are created. Also, standard DDS deadline QoS is supported, as well as ownership and strength, which allow applications to manage redundancy. So these, at a high level, are the QoS available in our certifiable DDS implementation. And with the durability QoS, we already touched upon system setup and initialization. Next, what I'd like to do is explain how components discover each other when they are brought online. So we'll look at the DDS discovery protocol and its implications for safety certifiable systems. The DDS standard has a discovery protocol by which components find out about each other's existence and set up connections. How this particular process is set up is very important for safety-critical systems. And to understand that, let's first take a look how the discovery protocol works in general. So DDS discovery is a process by which applications find out about each other. So for each application, the middleware maintains a database. That's a discovery database we talked about earlier. And discovery happens automatically behind the scenes. Applications continuously refresh their presence or they are aged out. And there are two stages of discovery. First, there is participant discovery. Participants periodically announce their presence using RTPS data messages. And these messages contain the participant's unique ID on the network, its network interfaces, and its QoS settings. An announcement is initially sent to all hosts and devices in the initial peers list. This is a configurable list, and this list allows you to scope the scope of discovery in the network. So after the initial announcement, then refresh messages are sent periodically to all discovered applications. So upon startup, an application will send an announcement that's depicted by hello on this slide. And this announcement is sent to all hosts and devices in the initial peer list. And in this example, we have just two peers to keep things simple. There's peer 1 and peer 2. So if a device is up, like peer 1, it sends an acknowledgement back to the sender. If the device is down, of course, there's no response. So now the application knows that peer 1 is up and peer 2 is down. And then after this follows the second stage of discovery. In the second stage, peers that are up are available, exchange information about their endpoints. And by endpoints, I mean publications and subscriptions. In the second phase of discovery, applications send out a message containing its list of publications and subscriptions. And it sends this message to each discovered peer. So in this example, just to peer 1. And upon receipt, peer 1 then responds by sending its publications and subscriptions in return. Should an application receive publication and subscription information from an unknown peer, it will send a NEC back and simply deny the message. So in this way, messages are denied from unknown peers. So this is the initial discovery exchange, and after the initial exchange, updates are sent when publications or subscriptions are added or removed dynamically, or when QoS is changed. So I hope this gives a high-level understanding of how discovery in DDS works, because now what I want to do is put this process in the context of safety-critical systems. So what you don't want to happen in a safety-critical system is a priori unknown number of applications to connect. Also, you don't want applications to dynamically create publications and subscriptions without any level of control. Avionics systems simply cannot be this dynamic. So what we see in avionics is that components have well-defined interfaces. For each subsystem or system component, we know what those interfaces are, we know what data it will publish and what data it will subscribe to. A whole device or subsystem by itself may be either up and or down, particularly during system initialization phase, but not individual endpoints or interfaces. They are on or off with the device as a whole. So really all we need to know is which DDS participants are available and which ones are not available. Once a participant is available, its interface is statically defined. And for this type of behavior, we can use a much simpler discovery protocol, much simpler than the full dynamic discovery protocol that I just explained. And this easier protocol is actually certifiable. And we call this protocol quasi-static discovery. So as full dynamic discovery, it consists of two stages. Stage one is the same as the dynamic participant discovery that I just explained, and it discovers which components are up, are available on the network. Stage two, however, is completely different. So rather than configuring and discovering publications and subscriptions dynamically over the network, it loads this configuration from file in quasi-static discovery. The end result is that you only have predefined components and interfaces on the network, which is exactly what you want in safety-certifiable systems, safety-critical systems. The code base for certifiable DDS implementation is based on ConnectCDS Micro, as I explained earlier, and that code base is available today. And right now we are working on developing the certification evidence, and we will have that available later in the year. The certification evidence will come on a DVD. It has all the required documents. It includes all the high-level and low-level requirements. It includes the architectural design description and has full traceability. And all the cross-references in the documents are hyperlinked for easy access. And, of course, the DVD has all the tests and all the test results. And now we get to the key message of this webinar. Many safety-critical systems today require some type of communication infrastructure. And by developing the certification evidence for that communication infrastructure once, you get the benefit of reusing the same evidence, the same set of documents and test results across many different projects. And that can be a significant cost saver. Because the alternative is that you write and certify the communication software code yourself. And the cost of doing that depends, of course, on the lines of code in the communication software, and it also depends on the required certification level. Now, remember that the cost of certification is about $100 per line of code at DL 178C Level A. So, for example, for 20,000 executable lines of code, the cost of just certification will be around $2 million for Level A, down to $1.2 million for Level C. And this is only the cost for certification, so it doesn't include the cost of developing the actual communication software code itself. Our certifiable DDS implementation is about 25,000 executable lines of code. Now, if you would develop the certification evidence yourself, it would cost you around $2.5 million for DL 178C Level A. The certification evidence that we're developing will be available at only a fraction of that cost. So this gives you well over $2 million in cost reduction. And more, of course, if you also account for the development of the 25,000 lines of code itself. Now, you may think, well, communication software for this particular project doesn't need the full DDS feature set. Well, keep in mind that certifiable DDS is already a subset of the full DDS feature set. It's a strongly reduced feature set tailored to safety-critical applications, and especially flight-critical applications. So it won't be so straightforward to implement communication software in less lines of code. But even if the custom-developed communication software is only, say, 10,000 lines of code, even then, at $1 million cost, the DDS certification evidence can be obtained at a fraction of that cost as well. And again, the cost of developing and testing the code must then be added to that. Plus, of course, having the code and its certification evidence and all the positive test results available at the start of the project is a major risk reduction for the project overall at the very start of the project. All right, so this brings me to the conclusion of this webinar. So certifiable communication middleware based on the widely adopted DDS standard is now available. This development comes from our background in UAVs and ground control stations, where we see an increasing requirement for safety certification, DL 178 certification, due to the integration of those systems in national airspace. Our safety certifiable middleware implementation is called the Connects DDS Cert, and the code base is derived from the currently available Connects DDS Micro product. It implements a subset of the standard DDS minimum profile, and it's RTPS compliant, which means that it's interoperable with other DDS implementations that perhaps implement the full DDS standard. It has a small footprint, and it's designed for safety certification, has around 25,000 lines of code, which is just a fraction of current full DDS implementations. It's also designed to be highly deterministic. It follows the guidelines for DL 178C certification up to level A, which is the highest level. The certification evidence, which will be available later this year, is reusable across many different applications, so that avoids replication of development efforts, resulting in significant cost and risk reduction of safety certification. If you haven't done so already, we invite you to give DDS a try in your current or maybe your next project. We have a free download of our full DDS product available from our website. And if you're interested in trying the safety certifiable implementation, please contact us. We can definitely set you up with a free evaluation of the software. So thank you very much for your attention. And with that, back to you, John.
Thanks, Edwin. Excellent presentation. Let's get right to the questions. First question, what processors and operating systems does the certification evidence support?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, we didn't get into that. It is a good question because the certification evidence is actually tied to a particular platform, so a particular board, particular processor, particular BSP compiler version. because in the end what gets certified is the binary image itself. And so when you use a different compiler or when you have a different processor with a different instruction set, that binary changes, and that means you have to recertify the software. So the platforms that the evidence will be available for, right now we are working on two platforms. One is the Excalibur 1700. It has a P2020 CPU, and it runs Wind River VxWorks cert. The other platform that we are targeting is a General Electric SBC312, which has a P4080, which is an 8-core CPU. And that one also runs VxWorks cert, but under Wind River Hypervisor. So those are the two platforms that that we are targeting for the initial certification evidence. It's important to point out, however, that even though when you have a different board and operating system combination, even though you will have to rerun all the tests, most of the certification evidence that we have developed is reusable, even if you have a different hardware platform and operating system. So all you would have to do basically is port the tests to that new platform, which is usually not a huge amount of effort, and then rerun all the tests, and based on the rerun tests, then create the updated certification evidence. But throughout that process, most of the certification evidence is fully reusable. So again, also that can be done at just a fraction of the cost of developing whole new certification evidence from the ground up.
Thanks, Edwin. Next question. There doesn't seem to be such a thing as phase compliant yet. Can you explain further what you mean by that statement on slide 15?
Yes, by that I mean that what we are working on is an implementation that is conformant to the phase transport services segment. The phase transport services segment is a middleware independent interface for communication between flight critical subsystems, flight critical components, and the phase TSS transport services segment specifies a couple of communication protocols that can be used when using a TSS, and DDS is one of the specified protocols that is supported by FACE. So that's what I meant, that what we have available is a FACE TSS conformant API that uses DDS as the underlying transport.
Thank you, Edwin. Next question from the audience. Can you mix certifiable with full DDS code in a system and still have the system certifiable?
Yes, you can do that. Of course, there needs to be clear separation between the two. So this is, for example, where you would use a space and time partitioned operating system like ARINC 653. What you could do is run a flight critical component that is certifiable according to DL178, maybe all the way up to level A. Run that in one partition, and you would use the certifiable DDS in that partition for communication from the partition, and then you can use a non-safety critical partition that runs other types of applications, like maybe mission type applications that use full DDS as the middleware, which maybe then connect off board to other non-flight critical components of the system. And since certifiable DDS and non-certifiable DDS, the full DDS implementation, are wire compatible. It is possible for the two to exchange the data, but they would run in different partitions of on the same board, or maybe even in on different boards in the network.
Okay. Thank you. Next question from the audience. Has your product ever been part of an FAA or equivalent system safety certification effort?
Not yet. So that's what we are working on. And the two platforms that I mentioned when I replied to the first question about which platforms are supported, those will be the first platforms that we will be using to actually take the software through certification for the first time. So what we're working on right now is to develop the certification evidence, prepare all that. The actual certification will then happen later on. So that that is something that we're working on. It has not gone through full certification with an aircraft yet.
Okay. The next two questions deal with RTPS wire protocol standards. First one says, safety critical communication typically requires network redundancy. The RTPS wire protocol standard doesn't address redundant network operation. How do you handle that problem in a DDS-based solution?
Yeah, so this is actually handled at the DDS level itself, not the the RTPS wire protocol level. There are different ways of implementing redundancy. One way is hot failover, and especially for time critical operations, that's usually what you want. So what DDS supports is, and I mentioned this this earlier, is redundant publishers, and of course also redundant subscribers, and then you can use ownership and strength as quality of service to configure the redundant components. And what happens is you have, for example, two publishers, so they're redundant publishers. They're both active, so they're both publishing data, but they're configured at different strengths. So one publisher is stronger than the other. And what happens on the subscriber side is that the subscriber will only accept messages, updates from the highest strength publisher. So the strength is a quality of service that is actually put on the message that we send. And when a subscriber receives updates, it will only pass updates from the strongest publisher up to the application, and it will filter out updates from the weaker publication, from the backup publisher. So when now the primary publisher fails, then the weaker publisher automatically becomes the stronger publisher, because that's then the highest strength value that you will be receiving from that moment on. So at that point, the subscriber automatically switches over to the backup publisher. And of course, you can have multiple publishers, right? It's not just two. You can have any number of publishers configured at different strengths, so you can have a cascading effect when multiple failures occur. So in that way, at the middleware layer, the filtering, automatic filtering of duplicates is done in DDS, and that's one way of supporting redundancy and particularly hot failover in this case.
Thank you. Next question, similar subject. Safety critical communication typically requires determinism or predetermined bandwidth allocation on the network. The RTPS wire protocol standard doesn't address determinism, predetermined bandwidth allocation, and network utilization. There is no way to limit the number and frequency of topic samples published. How do you handle that problem in a DDS-based solution?
Yeah, that depends. If let's say strict time determinism is needed, where you need to have pre-allocated bandwidth available on the network, then that's actually typically handled at a lower level in the network stack than DDS. So DDS actually supports, our implementation of DDS supports pluggable transports. So the transport over which DDS itself runs is highly configurable. And the non-determinism is not so much introduced or DDS, it is actually introduced by the underlying networking technology that you use. Often this is Ethernet, which is non-deterministic. However, there are deterministic transports available, like time-triggered Ethernet, which, you know, often when used in combination with a time and space partitioned operating system can give a very time deterministic results, and there you can basically get your bandwidth reservations on the network. So what I'm trying to say here is that the certifiable DDS can be configured to run over, for example, time-triggered Ethernet, which will then give you those guarantees. So it's more a property of the underlying networking technology lower in the networking stack that gives you or doesn't give you those guarantees.
Okay, last question. Are there any restrictions on data types in certifiable DDS?
Oh, that's also a good question. I realized that we didn't cover that. We did talk a lot about the DDS feature set that is supported in certifiable DDS, but we didn't talk about the data types. And I guess that's because basically there are no restrictions on the data types. Certainly not in theory. It is the case that our current implementation supports pretty much all of the standard DDS data types. What is not supported today are bit fields and pointers. Those are the only two exceptions, but it was more because there was no clear requirement for those types of data in the applications that we've been involved in, that we've not implemented it yet, but there's no reason from a safety certification perspective why those couldn't be implemented. So no, there are basically no restrictions on the data types. We support everything except those two. And it also even includes sequences, nested sequences, everything. So virtually no restrictions there.
Okay, thank you, Edwin. And that brings us right up to our time limit for today. I'd like to thank Edwin DeYoung for speaking today, and RTI for sponsoring today's event. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be a MP3 version of the event available as well. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media eCast. Goodbye.